and it was Finlay and Lucy who found the letter, and it was addressed to a house, but it's now a block of flats. And because it was the pandemic, Lucy was clearly bored of Finlay. She went downstairs, she was sorting out all the takeaway delivery leaflets, and suddenly this little tiny letter just fell at the bottom. And it took them a while to kind of figure out why it was such an unusual letter. And then when they realised it was 1916, they figured they were okay to open it up and read what was inside.
Faith at the Fringe, a Sanctuary First podcast series. Uncovering God in the creative arts. At the biggest international arts festival in the world, Sanctuary First stops to ask, where does faith and art meet?
Welcome to Faith at the Fringe 2024. Here we are with episode 3 of our podcast series, where we delve into the whole place of faith at the fringe. Is there a place for faith at the fringe? And what is it? Where we think about art, which gives us the space so often to have a place of wonder. And in that space of wonder, is there a wondering about faith? Does it have a place to shape and form our wonderings and society as well? So that is what we are exploring in our podcast series. And you may already spot our friend with us today is Hannah Sanderson.
Hello again. Tis me.
It is, good friend of Sanctuary First and also Programme and Innovations Manager at the Church of Scotland. But delighted that you are a well-kent face for us at Sanctuary First. And our guest today is none other than Johnny Hanscom.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us, Johnny. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So Johnny is from Goodwolf People and you have a fabulous play called The 100-Year-Old Letter.
That's right.
It is, but you are not new to the Fringe nor to Edinburgh, is that correct?
No, that's right. I've been coming to the Fringe as an audience member. Well, the first time I came was 1994. So what was that, 3 years ago?
Yeah, definitely.
and then in 2019, we brought up to professional shows for the whole month. This time it's our community theatre group. So we're here just really for that first week. I think we're performing for 9 days. We're actually doing 11 shows.
And where are you performing? Are tickets still available?
They are not, I'm afraid. We sold out 2 or 3 weeks before the Fringe started. So we were the 12th show of 2024 to sell out, just before Mary Black and Dara Breen. So we just beat them to the sellout. It's been very surreal.
And when you said come up, where are you based?
We're based in South London, Southeast London. The play, The 100-Year-Old Letter in the title, was a letter that got delivered in Crystal Palace in 2021 and had been posted in 1916. So there's a little bit of a delay on the postal service there. But we talk about the address where it arrived at. We talk about other houses in the area that people involved in the story have lived at. And the particular drama group that we run that devised this, or went through the devising process that created this play. When I walked to rehearse, I'd actually walk past the road where the letter arrived, and I'd walk past the house where they ended up living. So it was just a really, really local story for us.
That's a lovely connection that you've got there, yeah. Actually, isn't it? It must really bring the letter to life.
It absolutely does. And I think if there's one thing that's kind of marked our journey with this play, it has just been the most extraordinary set of, I don't know if you call them coincidences, it's got a life of its own. It feels like, so the couple who opened the letter, it arrived during the pandemic, and it was Finlay and Lucy who found the letter, and it was addressed to a house, but it's now a block of flats. And because it was the pandemic, Lucy was clearly bored of Finlay. She went downstairs, she was sorting out all the takeaway delivery leaflets, and suddenly this little tiny letter just fell at the bottom. And it took them a while to kind of figure out why it was such an unusual letter. And then when they realised it was 1916, they figured they were okay to open it up and read what was inside. From that moment onwards, all kinds of magic happened, really. We just started a new year. We usually do a devising process from kind of January to March. People will bring ideas. I'll guide us through playing with those. We'll turn that into a story, and then I'll go away, write that script, and then we'll come back and rehearse that. And we just started, and somebody had brought in a book by a French philosopher, because we're that kind of group. We're very much not that kind of group. But somebody had got a book that they'd studied at university, which was Elements of Rhythm Analysis. And yeah, exactly. And the principle of this book is just about human beings creating rhythms. And the way that he talks about us creating rhythms is when, I think he says, when human energy is expounded in a particular space over time, rhythms are created. So it's about human actions carrying on through time, and eventually we kind of come up with this rhythm of history. I think like a good example is, you know, when they build a path through a park and they put it in a really stupid place and nobody uses it, so you end up with a natural path through the grass. It's those kinds of rhythms on a much bigger scale. So just a few weeks into rehearsal, this story broke in the news, and one of our team, who's actually in this production, funnily enough, heard it on a podcast. And she brought that story in of this letter that had arrived 100 years late. And we were like, it's local. It's about two different things happening in the same place at different times. Let's play with this idea. And it started off as just one little part of a much bigger story. We kind of had Joseph Paxton, we had Crystal Palace Park, we had the war, we had like all of this stuff going on, different historical letters. And we actually, what we didn't get to do last year is actually put on a production. So as I say, normally we'd spend half the year and finish with a kind of summer production. But I think through circumstances, through the cost of living crisis, through just life, people weren't able to commit as much time last year. But it meant we actually spent longer playing with the ideas. And by the end of that process, we hadn't put on a play, but I was like, I'm kind of in love with this now. Like, I need to go in and write this play. So it started as almost a 2-hour thing, I think, and we did a reading of that, rehearsed reading of, well, not even a rehearsed reading, we just sat and read it together. People fed back, said what they thought, which bits interested them, and then normally our plays would be on for about an hour. We normally perform in a church hall in Dulwich, but quite a modern one, so it's just got a sort of light well in the middle, and it's a place that this particular group was sort of a spin-off from a local amateur musical group who we're just friends with. But they're the most inclusive group. They're just lovely. They're like, if anyone auditions, they automatically get in. There is no, you know, people will just get a part. And they've had lots of members who've got complex mental health needs or autism or whatever. And they're just this, they just support everyone and welcome everyone in. So it just was a really good fit with us. But because they only did musicals, there were some members who didn't particularly feel like they were singers or dancers, but loved that group. So I'd said a long time before, like, if you ever want to do a straight play, I'll volunteer, I'll just direct that. And there were members who did want to do that. And then suddenly there was this problem of, you're like, with the musicals, everybody gets a part. You can't cast a play and everybody from a script and everyone gets a part. So I went to their chair, who's a really good friend of mine, and said, how do you feel about if we devise something? And all the blood drained from her face. And she went, I don't know. Let me ask. And all the people that were interested came back and went, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do that. So we started devising. And then we had the thing of like, where do we perform? What do we do with this? And that group is called the Phoenix Players. And the church hall that we were in was clearly had been built after the Blitz, because Dulwich got really heavily bombed because the government lied about where they were based and said they were based in Dulwich. Which is nice of them. So that particular church hall was a, you know, sort of post-war modern space. And we decided to do a piece called The Ashes. And it was based on our local history. And it kind of went from, I think the start of the war, just before the start of the war, and it sort of went up to about the coronation. And everyone in the group just picked a piece of history, a character that really interested them and had connection to their own personal life. And then we created the characters based around that and just kind of told that story. So there was a lot of people telling the stories of their family members.
That is beautiful.
It was so beautiful. It was so beautiful.
Oh, I can imagine just how people would be really engaged with it and so authentic as well. It would be But that's not what you, is that what Sorry, you did no, that's here not, as well?
Well, it's the same, it's very similar process. So that's the process we've used now for 5 years. But what we initially, the initial problem was like, where do we perform this? Because it's like, it doesn't feel like it should be done in a traditional kind of theatre space. So we decided we'd perform it in that church hall, and we just put chairs all the way around the light well, did it in the round, which nobody had done before, none of the group had done before. And it just worked so well. So we've done small intimate pieces. So this idea with the 100-year-old letter, we had this kind of sprawling 2-hour script that was too big, too long, too many elements. So it was like, all right, how do we bring this into the kind of shape that we would normally use? But in the meantime, the church hall, and they're lovely, they're really lovely people, but they literally had to double their prices because of the cost of energy, because they hadn't put their price up a long time. And whilst the musical has a lot of, you know, a lot of numbers of members of cast, so they have families, so they can sell tickets, we'd never have more than probably 8 people in the actual show, even though there's more often involved in the devising process. There's literally no way we could have covered those costs. For a year, we had funding from Awards for All, from the lottery, which was brilliant. But then that turned into the pandemic. So actually, we ended up doing audio plays for those 2 years. But with this one, we kind of went, okay, we can't use the same venue. We couldn't actually put it on last year anyway because of commitment. So it suddenly became this slightly mysterious, what are we going to do with this play? And this is where it comes back to Finley and Lucy. So it turns out Finley is a theatre director and Lucy is a theatrical agent.
In real life.
In real life. And she actually says, because I then interviewed them both when we found out that we wanted to play with this letter and they were local. I just tracked him down on the internet and went, would you mind if we just did a little interview? And they've been brilliant. They've been so helpful. But when I was talking to Finley, he was like, oh, do you know the Bridge House Tavern in Penge, which is a pub theatre? And I was aware that it was there, but I'd known it in its kind of previous incarnation where it probably did 2 shows a year and very much not my kind of thing. But in the meantime, these 2 lovely guys had taken it over and had this fantastic kind of programme of stuff. And they're really, again, it's one of the probably the only theatres I would say in London where they're set up. They make so little money out of it, but it's set up so that people that couldn't afford to put on a play normally can have that experience. So actually, I think the basic deal is you need to guarantee £100 a night for a 5-night run. And if you get that through, then everything's a 60-40 split in your favour. And they throw in the tech for that as well. And they're and this is the thing, the further this letter has taken us, we just keep encountering the most beautiful people, which is just so lovely. So Finley introduced us to them. And then they were like, we'd really love to get you in as a community production. Actually, would you mind doing a 2-week run? Because we're just experimenting with this. And I was like, I'll ask. I mean, I've done that before, but I'm like, I know these guys haven't. And they were very much up for it. So we did our 2-week run in London. And somewhere during that process, because I'd kind of realized that because we couldn't afford that hall anymore, because people hadn't been able to necessarily fully commit last time, it's like, okay, we'll put a full stop on that group. And what would be really great is to start a new group around Penge, which is kind of more in the area that I normally work. And we've got some contacts there, so maybe we can make this happen. And this would be a nice way to launch it. But then everyone had put so much into the previous 5 years, it'd be really nice to celebrate this in some way. And having done Edinburgh before, I was like, I think we can probably make this happen because we could only do a week because of people's availability. I'd done it in 2019 and had a really good idea of how to make it as cost effective as possible. And we're in amateur groups and none of us are getting paid, which is the biggest cost normally. So I kind of just put it out there and went, anyone interested? And people were, but actually only 4 of us could commit to all of those dates. And then once that process started, it just all completely spiraled madly out of control. And we put the tickets up on the website and our blurb on the website for the initial kind of deadline so that it got round out there on the first round, just because then it was done more than anything else. And that was April, or it went live in April. And within a few weeks, we were starting to sell tickets. And I was like, I have done Edinburgh before and I know this is very, very unusual. I'm pretty sure we'd sold about 10 tickets the week before our previous shows that we'd brought up. I'm like, okay, that's really, really odd. Somebody was just being very enthusiastic. And then the ticket sales kept ticking over and kept ticking over. And suddenly, like a couple of months before the festival, was like, I think we're going to sell out, which was just unheard of. We're like, you know, a community theatre group from South London selling out their first Fringe show seemed quite unlikely. And in the end, we were doing our two-week run in Penge, and we'd sold out Edinburgh before we'd done a single performance. And we're like, what if we made a really bad sell-out Edinburgh show that is going to be so embarrassing? This could all backfire really horribly.
But of course it hasn't.
No, exactly.
But there must be, it sounds, Hannah, I don't know about you, but there, what I'm hearing is there must be something of beauty and something special in this, in this play that's capturing people's attention. So I'm wondering about the themes that are in this play.
Yeah.
Because you've been talking there about the people and the heart involved. And so I'm kind of going, well, no wonder it's captivating people, right? What about the content itself? About what are those themes that are really catching people's attention?
So I think the main thing is the letter itself. So when it hit the press, all anybody knew was the content of the letter, and there was no other information. But the main thing about that was it was a letter of apology. So it was a letter of apology that never arrived.
Very British. How very British.
Isn't it? And the best bit is she actually says, don't trouble to write. So you're like, so you wouldn't know, would you? That it never arrived because you said don't write back. So, oh no.
Yeah.
And the actual apology itself, she's like, I'm feeling so ashamed of what I said at the Circle. And everyone's like, oh, what's the Circle?
Yeah.
Is that a place? Is it a seance? Is it a sewing circle? What is it?
Yeah.
So I think you had that thing of like, it's an apology that never got through. You had a letter that contained a lot of really mysterious things that you could play with your imagination, which is why we took it on as a show. And I feel like people have kind of remembered that. But I think for us, what's emerged is the two women who wrote and received the letter. I'm completely in love with both of them now. They are phenomenal. And the woman who wrote the letter, there's actually lots and lots of documentary evidence about her life and the incredible things she did. And of course, nobody's ever heard of her because she's a woman and she got written out of history because who wants to read about women?
We do.
Exactly. And so do we.
Yeah, just for the record, Christabel Mennel. Christabel Mennel, we know your name.
Absolutely. Except it's actually, no, you're saying it right, aren't you? We were saying, for ages, we were saying it the wrong way. So what were we saying? We were saying Mennel. And then there's a character in the play who was a school friend of hers, or a lifelong friend of hers, who kept a diary. And her grandson has put that diary online. So that's one of our sources of documentary evidence. And he came to see the show. I went, oh, no, it's Mennel. It's not Mennel.
Aww.
And he was lovely. So far we've had, in the audience, we've had Finley and Lucy who came to see it, who are characters in the show. Lovely Benjamin Beck, who put the diaries online, whose grandma is a character in the show, came to see it. And there was also a local historian who did a lot of the initial research. And he's a character in the show who also came to see it. And actually there is something that Finley said in his interview, which is it's something about how it's harmless. It captures the imagination. People love it. And I think that's still completely true. But the more you find out about these women, the more you're just like, they are amazing. And I really care about what happened between them. And from a historical point of view, the theory was always like, we'll never know what that apology was about, because that's a small personal incident. That's not going to be a recorded thing. And that's initially where our story, we thought our story would end in a very open way. And we took lovely Stephen Oxford's historical research. He's from the Norwood Society, a local historical society. And then we just kind of, or I went and locked myself in a room and just kept digging deeper and kept digging deeper. And I think because I was coming at these resources not from a historical point of view but from a storytelling point of view, and you start to see other connections. And I think also because I'm ADHD, I'm just seeing all of these connections everywhere. I'm going, oh, this fits with that, oh wow. And suddenly it's like I have a really good idea what this apology probably was about. Mm-hmm. And that's, we've now included that within the play.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Definitely no spoilers.
But the Broadway run.
Quite. But what it's meant in terms of the way the show comes together is it's a fast-paced romp. Now, we actually, the show, that as we did it in London was running when we very started that, or just before we started that run, it was probably running at about 1 hour, 2 minutes. So we're like, oh, we'll need to take a couple of minutes off for Edinburgh. By the end of the run, it was running at 1 hour 13. We're like, we need to take quite a lot off this play. So we had to sort of re-rehearse with a load of cuts, but the cuts have made it so much better. There's probably two or three that will go back in when we go back to London, but most of them were like, no, this is really slick now. It just bombs through. And I think the fear was, we've got a lot of historical context information in there because you really need it to understand the human story. You kind of need to know the world that these women were living in. And I think particularly, so it's a letter written in 1916 and it never mentions the war at all. Which is actually, it turns out to be quite significant.
Okay.
So now I've completely lost the thread of where I was going.
Well, that's
going.
Good, because I want to ask you a question.
Oh, good, excellent.
So I'm going to jump right in.
Good.
I want to take you back to your French philosopher.
Yes.
And your kind of rhythms of human energy creating history. I think that's really fascinating. Rabbit hole warning. So I'm just wondering, you know, do you think that as we, the humans, create history and the expressions that we put out into the space and the expressions that we put out into the world, the energy that we do that, where do you think that, is that a foundational block for your creativity? Is that, do you think, would you go wider and say that's a foundational block for creativity itself? How do you see that?
I think it's like, it's the absolutely fundamental part of storytelling, isn't it? Is that stories kind of start somewhere and then they take a trail through space and time, essentially. And I definitely think my creative process is completely about just finding that little thread and then giving it a tug and seeing what happens. And that idea of just human energy creating those rhythms, and then they can just sit there untouched, unlooked at for 100 years, and then you pull one little thread and suddenly this huge story comes out of it, and these people that you start to really, really passionately care about, and they feel like friends. They really become a part of your life, and then you really start to question, you look around and kind of go, what are the things that are being written out or will be written out from now? What are the things that I look at and think are really important, a really intrinsic part of who I am and the world I live in, that it's not in somebody's interest to record that. So it's just kind of going to get sidelined somewhere along the way.
Well, that's really interesting as well, isn't it? You know, he or she who writes the history, you know.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem, that it's usually he.
Yeah.
Is exactly it.
Yeah. I mean, those of the watchers who remember last year's interviews, I always like to go, I'm like, I like deep, you know, let's go there, you know. Ruth is like, oh no, what are you going to ask?
Not at all. That's why you're here.
So I think one of the things that I'm really interested in, obviously, you know, as a Christian person, is the understanding of energy. I'm fascinated by that. So what do we mean by the word energy? And obviously now we're starting to learn so much more about how, even as we speak, we move the air and there becomes an energy wave. And even as we, these kinds of things, you know, and where light bounces off and how we see that and all these kinds of things based around what we're now finding in science. We've now got the language to put science around it, which is wonderful. But, you know, back in the day, we didn't have that scientific language. So people put languages of faith around it. Now, for me, I'm like, you know, different language, same story for me. And so I'm just wondering, for you, as clearly a very artistic person, you've already mentioned your ADHD, which I think has strong links with creativity and abstract thought. You know, as a Christian, I might put a label on that of the narrative that you're seeing is something that's being highlighted by, I would say, the Holy Spirit. But other people would say by energy, by a longing, by a drawing in yourself. Where would you like to put the boundaries of your language around that so that we understand you as a person?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. Because obviously coming on the podcast, and I was really thinking about that, and I don't have any particular religious faith. And I think that's probably true of all the cast and crew as well. But I am really, really driven by the desire to kind of make a difference. And the more you can, or the more I can tangibly see that what I'm doing is making a difference to somebody's life or to somebody's quality of life. That's what drives me and what drives all of my work. And that obviously then, this is a play. And so in a way, the social output of this was the experience of making the play. But you can't separate those things. So it just bleeds into absolutely everything that you do. And I think for me, it's about always trying to feel like I'm doing the right thing. And that's a big question. What's the right thing? You know, everyone's got their own interpretation of that. And I guess I measure that by looking at the people I'm working with and seeing what they're getting out of it. Mm. So when I talked about the first play that we did, The Ashes, seeing people suddenly literally make connections with family members and find out stories that they hadn't known and then put those on the stage, and then their family comes and sees that play. Mm. And you can see something really, really magical and tangible happening in that space. And every time that happens in a project, it kind of pushes you on. So for example, a project I've been doing for nearly 2 years now, in Croydon, Croydon was the London Borough of Culture last year. And I got commissioned to write a production of Pinocchio for a brilliant, brilliant local inclusive theatre company called Savvy. And that production was then made up of nine community groups. So they had children, teens, adults, three learning disabled groups, a homeless experience group. And then new to that particular year, they started working with Mind in Croydon. And I went in and ran that group. And they ended up being really informative in how the play was structured. In that they kind of create a lot of that structure. And then at the end of the Borough of Culture year, there was no continuation funding. And at the start of that, you said actually they'd had a little drama group within Mind that had been running for 6 years, but it was a member of staff who'd been doing drama games, and then they'd read some stuff, and then they might do a rehearsed reading in their common room. And that was brilliant. And they probably had five or six like regular core members, and then people would drop in. And the timing of the whole thing, I was going to go in and support this person for the year, and then actually he got made redundant and he left like a week after I started. So like, okay, we're going on a slight different tangent with this then.
So this would be me. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And also, as I say, they'd done rehearsed readings in their community room. They were about to step onto the main stage at Fairfield Halls in Croydon with a 900-seat capacity. Gosh. Slight difference. Mm. So it was like, it was that journey. It's like, we've got to take these people experiencing mental health issues. And we're going to put them on a stage in front of 900 people. That has to be safe. They have to want to do that. They have to feel okay with that. And by the end of that year, I think we'd got 14 regular members and another 15 people who dropped in and out. And it felt amazing. And suddenly it's like, there's no more money. And by this point, though, somebody else had been helping me run the group in the last few months of rehearsals. So I kind of just said to Mind, look, we'll carry on looking for funding, but in the meantime, you can't just stop that. That would be awful. And would also, like, people had started to identify how much it was helping them with their mental health. So you're like, absolutely not. So it's like, I will volunteer until we've got some funding. And then lovely Andrea, who I was delivering it with, I was like, I'm not going to ask Andrea to do it for nothing because that's just rude. And then she messaged me, went, can I do it as well, please? Of course you can, absolutely. So she came back, and I think we probably volunteered with that for about 6 months. And then now we've got 2 years worth of continuation funding through Mind and through the lottery. So it's just that thing where you kind of go, that was doing the right thing. Mm. And I think that's what drives all of my work. Yeah.
Because I noticed that you'd said to remain unheard, to disappear, is something that is a symptom of disempowerment. And that's something that drives your personal kind of work, is that, well, really from your blog, your life, it sounds like. And I just thought that was so wonderful that actually what you've created here is a theatre piece where the voice of that letter was unheard, voice of that letter was undiscovered. And then through this piece, it's almost like you're a living analogy of the essence of why you do what you do.
It's kind of, I think, I had a company in Bedfordshire from 2002, and we literally had to close the day after the 2010 election because we just knew we were losing everything. And we'd gone, and this is not how I measure success, but we had gone from, in our first year, I think we had a turnover of 7,000, and by the end of year five, it was 250,000. But we were not for profit, and all of that money went into, so most of our staff by that point were young people that we'd worked with, young people from care, young offenders. So it was devastating to have to shut that down and let all of those people down. It was just horrible and took years to recover from. What I found by the end of that process is because it was going out every day and trying to represent the voices of these people and get them heard by the people that make decisions about them. And what it did to me was incredible, because it meant that every day I was involved in something that was trying to do something that was for the greater good.
Yeah.
And then that just became embedded, and then you just couldn't help it every time you opened your mouth. It was really lovely. It took a long while to recover from that, and I was incredibly lucky. I grew up on a pig farm in Bedfordshire, and we never had any money, and we used to joke about, you know, one day we'll sell it for millions. And then we did. very unexpectedly. But it enabled me to then set up Good Wolf. So people were like, you've just got a life-changing amount of money. I think I got £4 million. It's like, you can do anything you want. What do you want to do? It's like, I want my old job back.
Yeah.
So we set up Good Wolf, and it was a totally different environment. Like, we put together what we thought would be a plan that would, after 5 years, make us sustainable. And then you realize the country's absolutely gone to the dogs. That's not happening. And it's taken till now. And now things are, in fact, when we brought the shows up in 2019, we knew we were going to lose loads of money, but one was about growing up in care and one was about teenagers trying to overcome family stuff and friendship. And what we really wanted out of that was like, it's fine, we're going to Edinburgh, it's going to cost a fortune, but we want to come back with a reputation that will embed us in our local community and bring us more work. And it totally
sold
did
out show, people. Sold out show.
That one was definitely not sold out. That was like, okay, we've been flying for 4 hours and we've got two people. As you do.
I really love how honest you've been with us in terms of just sharing really where you're coming from as well. And it's been really wonderful to hear from you. And as we've got a couple of minutes left, and I think what I would really appreciate hearing from you is that question about, is there a place for faith at the fringe? And that's why I'm saying I really appreciate you've been open and honest with us to say where you're coming from. I love your heart of goodness and kindness. I'm like, that's just what changes the world. So I would love to hear from your perspective. Do you think that there is a place for faith at the fringe?
Well, it's a really funny thing, because I came along here laboring under quite a misapprehension as to why I'd been invited. Because I assumed it was because, you know, our show was a show about Quakers.
Why was he invited?
Maybe that was it, and you just haven't asked the question. But it is. And we've all fallen in love with the Quakers as well during this process. And what's been amazing in the whole run is how many people have stayed around afterwards to tell us about their experiences of either growing up as a Quaker or... And one of the things I particularly love about the Quakers is, like, I'm so aligned on values, and you don't even need to be religious to be a Quaker. I'm like, well, I think I've just found the thing I could join. But what I found really interesting is, for all of us, because we've become very engaged with these women and their lives and their beliefs, and one of the most important things in all of that is the idea that Quakers are all individuals who all worship in their own way. So there's no set hard and fast rules. A couple of days ago, I think it was just that fringe thing of, like, even when you've got a sellout show and it's all going really well, it's still a big emotional roller coaster. I was like, I just really need some space. And where we are on George Street, you'll know the name of the church and I don't. It's a beautiful domed church with a spire. And I was actually looking for a cafe to sit quietly and went, but I really don't want a coffee. And then I noticed this church had a cafe. I went, they probably won't mind. And then when I went in, you could walk into the church. I was like, oh, actually, that's perfect. So I just kind of went and sat in the church for half an hour, and it was cool. And the chairs were kind of really comfortable and just arranged in a very, very much like our show. And actually, it's as every building in Edinburgh is, it's also a venue, so it got lights in it. So it felt like I was sitting in a place of worship and a theatre at the same time. And that's not something I would ever normally do, but that's what this show has done. It's enabled me to step into a space that I wouldn't normally necessarily even feel comfortable in, and feel absolutely at home and feel really safe and really appreciate the fact that that's there. And I think just from the conversations we're having with audience members and the way that they relate to those parts of the story, yeah, I think there's definitely a place for Faith at the Fringe, a big one.
Thank you. That is just a beautiful message just to finish up on, understanding and hearing from you that actually people of faith and places of faith offer sanctuary.
Absolutely.
Don't they? They
yeah,
offer
definitely.
That safe place to be, whether that's in art or it's in a physical building or it's in relationship or it's in thought. It's just really, really good to hear from you. Thank you so much, Johnny, for coming on with Hannah and myself.
Thank
Hannah,
you
thanks
so
for
much
joining
for
us.
You.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. And if people would like to hear a little bit more about the 100-year-old letter and or Good Wolf Company, where can we find out a bit more?
Well, if anyone happens to be visiting South London in September, we're doing another week there. But actually, if you Google Good Wolf People somewhere on our website, there's a page where we put the program and things, so we didn't have them printed off. But we've also put links to a lot of the historical sources and to the Quakers. So all of the things that are in the play, you can go on there and find out a lot more about them.
Lovely. Thank you. And of course, we will post the link in our description as well for the podcast. But thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for joining us on this podcast for Faith at the Fringe, episode number 3. I hope you have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I certainly have. It's been brilliant. And I look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.